This message comes from NPR sponsor Acorn TV. Acorn TV is brilliant television told brilliantly. From charmingly cozy mysteries to daringly dark dramas, visit acorn.tv for a 30-day free trial with promo code NPR. Acorn TV. Brilliant.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley. We're wrapping up the 50th anniversary of hip-hop by looking back at some of our most memorable interviews with performers who hold a significant place in history. Our first interview is with RZA, the chief composer and producer of the Wu-Tang Clan, which has often been called one of the most revolutionary rap groups of the mid-90s. They turned the concept of a hip-hop crew inside out by creating a collective of nine MCs who also created their own music under different pseudonyms. RZA is also known as Prince Rakim, Bobby Digital, the Resurrector, and Robert Diggs, which is his birth name. He joined his cousins, GZA the Genius, an old dirty bastard, in 1992 to form the Wu-Tang Clan. Martial arts movies had a big influence on RZA growing up. The name Wu-Tang Clan was inspired by kung fu movies and a mythical martial sword technique. RZA also composed music for several films, including Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, as well as Kill Bill in its sequel, directed by Quentin Tarantino. Recently, RZA was one of the executive producers of the Hulu series Wu-Tang, an American Saga, which chronicled the rise of the group. The third and final season wrapped up in April. Terry Gross spoke with RZA in 2005 after the release of his book, The Wu-Tang Manual. We start with a single, Cream, from the Wu-Tang's 1993 debut album.
I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job, had second hands. Moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin land. A young youth, you're rocking the go-to. Low goose, only way I begin to G-York was drug loot. And let's start it like this, son. Rolling with this one and that one, pulling out gats for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking wools at 16 and running up in gates and doing hits for high stakes. Making my way on fire skates. No question, I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question, I would flow up and try to get the door.
That's the Wu-Tang Clan. My guest is the RZA. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, y'all.
Now, you know, in addition to being, you know, an MC and to being one of the rappers with Wu-Tang Clan, you were also the chief producer and arranger. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, composing and sampling the music backing for the records? What your approach is to that?
Well, my musical knowledge really came from being a DJ. You know, at the age of 11, I got my first pair of turntables, straight arm techniques, you know what I mean? The hardest ones that you could scratch on. And I was in, building up an extensive record collection. Even as a DJ with a four-track, my production style was similar to the style you hear on 36 Chambers, which was taking something from old soul music to something from a funky drum, you know, whether James Brown or Willie Mitchell-type drum pattern, and then come with maybe a Woody Woodpecker record, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then mix that in with some kind of classical. So I was a kind of DJ that would do that. When I would DJ at parties, you know, when I would interlude between records, I may throw on a Peter Pan quote or something and then throw on a crazy hip-hop gutter beat that makes the crowd go crazy. So when I start producing, I had that same approach.
So were you, you know, since you had such a wide variety of musical records that you were drawing from, were any of those records things that you first heard from your parents' record collections?
Oh, guaranteed. I mean, you know, it's, everything started from what our parents had, of course.
So what was in your parents' collection?
Oh, my parents had all the soul records from, you know, from I had a single mother most of the time, but from the Crusaders to the OJs to the Delphonics to the Temptations, you know what I mean? All the way to Kenny Rogers was in the crate, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
My mother was, being a single mother, I guess she probably went through a lot of different feelings and changes. And she had a lot of different artists and records that she would play, you know, over the years. But what made my selection and collection so ill was, it wasn't only my parents' records. I was taking everybody's parents' records, you know what I mean? I went to inspect the deck house, and his mother had a whole closet full of old records that she gave me. Ghostface Moms, I mean, people that be in New York City in the village just selling records on the street corner. I'm the kind of kid that buys everything. I used to buy records everywhere, anywhere, no matter what. And I'm still kind of like that, you know. I've collected records from over probably 40 different countries.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started composing. Because, you know, you first were DJing, basically. You were sampling things from records and playing records under raps. But you actually compose now. So how did you make that transition?
That was pretty something that came to being. I think around 1995, 96, you know, I had a few platinum records under my belt already. I was getting worldwide recognition and really a lot of praises from the music industry and the community about what I did, what I've done, the sound that I was bringing to the table. But I took a look and was like, you know what? Wow, I'm considered a famous musician, but technically, as far as terminology, I'm not a musician because there's no instrument that I could really say I could play. And so I kind of felt like I'm one of the kind of people that like to be part of a fraternity because he earned it. And so I took the time out to start reading books on the music theory and studying chord progressions and the way things should be. Because I always heard it, you know what I mean? Always heard it, you know, by listening to songs or if you listen to some of my samples. When hip-hop was only doing one-loop samples or maybe two-bar samples, I came with the four bars or I came with you know, sample changes, you know, as if I played it, you know what I mean? I was able to take, you know, three different parts from one song and make it become, you know, an intro, a verse, and a chorus. So I had the song structure and arrangement always in my mind, but I had to use other people's music. But around 1996, I decided to start studying the theory and being able to make my own progressions and make my own phrases of music. And that's what started leading into me being a composer. You know, I always sampled stuff that was similar to that anyway, and so I wanted to learn how to play it myself, how to express it myself. And I think in 1997 on the Wu-Tang Forever album, you first hear me doing things like that. You listen to songs like Triumph, and you hear how the strings, you know, they come in. They have, you know, it's play staccato, but it's a rise to it. So it's like dun 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 dun. It rises up and then they drop out, and then the voice will come in, and then that'll drop out. Then you just hit a guitar hit with the piano. So that was like doing 97 is when I started experimenting with the theory of music, chord progressions, and things like that, mixed with my sample DJ background. And that's how I produced Wu-Tang Forever.
Well, let's hear Triumph from Wu-Tang Forever. Here it is.
I bomb atomically. Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't define how I be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically perform armed robbery. Flee with the lottery. Possibly they spotted me. Battle scarred shogun. Explosion when my pen hits. Tremendous. Ultraviolet shine blind forensics. I inspect view through the future. See millennium. Killer bees sold 50 gold, 60 platinum. Shackling the matches with drastic rap tactics. Graphic displays melt the steel like blacksmiths. Black Wu Tack is Queen Bee's ease to guns in. Rumble with patrolmen, tear gas, lace the function. Heads by the score, take flight inside a war. Ticks hit the floor, die hard fans demand more. Behold the bold soldier, control the glow slowly. Proceeds the blow, swinging swords like Shinobi. Stomp grounds and found footprints in solid rock. Who got it locked, performing live on your hottest fly.
As the world turns, I spread like germ. Bless the globe with the pestilence. The hard-headed never learn. This my testament to those burned. Play my position in the game of life, standing firm. On foreign land, jump the gun out the frying pan. Into the fire, transform into the Ghost Rider. A six-pack and a streetcar named Desire.
That's Triumph from the album Wu-Tang Forever. And my guest is the RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan, also a solo artist. You know, you do something on some of your music that I think you call a detuned piano. And listening to it, I never knew whether it was an electric piano or what, but it has this really distinctive sound. And in fact, I want to play something from the Jim Jarmusch movie, Ghost Dog: The Way of the Samurai. And you did the score for this movie, and it's really,
yeah, that's my first score.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful. Let me play the theme from it.
Thank you.
That's music from the Jim Jarmusch movie, Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, composed by my guest, the RZA. What are you doing on that? What's the keyboard that we're hearing?
The keyboard that I use for Ghost Dog, I use a combination, but I use mostly, it's a keyboard called the Kurzweil 2500, and there's another keyboard called the Insonic ASR-10. And the ASR-10 is a sampling keyboard. The Kurzweil is also a sampling keyboard, but it's made with this thing they call VAS technology, which is Variable Architect Synthesis Technology. And that means that this particular keyboard can emulate any other keyboard ever created. If you just use the filters and play with the filters,
mm-hmm.
it can emulate any other keyboard and potentially any instrument if you know the proper parameters. And the Ghost Dog theme, the doo-doo, it sounds like it was a partial of a flute sample, just taken out just one frequency of it, and then played across the piano. So that was how I came up with that right there, mixed in with some muddy string pads, you know what I mean, and a muddy string guitar sample. Da-na-na-na. So it was a pretty awkward combination, but the sound of it. But the sound of it is funny. When I made that particular song, the sound of it was to go along with Ghost Dog. Had a lot of birds in this movie, you know. And reading, studying music, I read about Peter and the Wolf, and how the composer used an instrument to reflect each animal. For instance, when the wolf came, he threw on the trombones. When the bird came, he threw on the flute. So this is why on the Ghost Dog theme, you hear that flute in there, because he had a lot of birds, and when the movie first came on, the bird was flying. So I started with that flute sound, so you could feel that joyfulness. But it's also put into a RZA context, so it's joy mixed with sorrow and morbid.
Morbidity, did you say? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's something very eerie about the theme.
That's what I mean. I think I meant eerie. Then, if morbid and eerie don't mean the same thing. Do they mean the same thing? Morbid
no.
and eerie?
Well, eerie is kind of mysterious, and morbid has to do with death, but I think it's both, because the movie has a lot to do with death.
Right. Well, I say eerie then, and morbid, because I wanted to be like the catch, you know, the catcher, you know, the spirituality of the bird, but also to capture like the internal of Ghost Dog. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
he's a very troubled individual, really.
So you use the word detuned. What do you mean by detuned, and what is detuned in the music we just heard?
When the piano gets old, right, and it sits in your studio for a long time, it becomes detuned, meaning, you know, all the notes are maybe not a half step, but maybe a 1/8 of a step just out of tune, mm-hmm. in the proper chromatic order. And I like that sound. You know, most people come in and go, I need to tune the keyboard, or I need to tune the piano, or tune the guitar. I like it when it's detuned, because that means it's not in the musical harmony according to the theory of music, but yet it has a harmony of its own. And that's something that I use a lot throughout whether I sampled the sound or whether I played it. That's the sound I use a lot.
And I think one of the reasons why that works when you do it is because you're often using like one note lines. So
exactly.
There aren't like chords that you're playing, because the chords might sound really raggy, but that single note line, it works
it
really well.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like a person that sings that doesn't really, that's vocal trained. He'll be able to, you know, he'll be able to sing and give you all the feelings he want to give you, but he may not be able to sing in the key of A, you know? But he'll be able to sing a song that's in the key of A, and just because of his, if he has a natural style and a good flow, it just somehow meshes all together. I think that's what hip hop singing is. You know, like a lot of hip hop artists that sing.
Right.
You hear some of these songs. I know, like, people hear it on the radio, like, how is this song on the radio? Or even one of the great hip hop R&B singers, Mary J. Blige, in her early career, a lot of, you know, trained musicians was like, oh, Mary's always out of tune. But the hip hop generation loved it, because there was no sound like that. His only sound was that, was her, you know?
You've had several personas over the years. I mean, your birth name is Robert Diggs. You're known as the RZA. That's a name you took when you co-founded the Wu-Tang Clan. Mm-hmm. You're also Bobby Digital. And early in your career, you were Prince Rakim. So let's start with Prince Rakim. I mean, what did you see that persona as being? The music that you made with him is different from Wu-Tang.
I would say so. Well, Prince Rakim, you know what I mean? I was basically more of a student in the studies of life, shall I say, and as well as definitely a student to music and the music industry and things like that. But as Prince Rakim, you know, being young, 17, 18 years old, you know, all you think about is girls, yo, you know what I mean? And I was, you know, pretty popular guy with the girls. Like, you know, a lot of girls found, you know, had good things to say about me. Oh, he's cute, and he always got on some polo and Gucci, and he's just, you know, and I actually like to carry myself like a prince. I was the kind of kid that, you know, kept his fingernails right, you know what I mean? Wouldn't touch my food without a napkin, and, you know, walked like Mr. Spock, had my hands behind my back. I used to walk very straight up and very, very elegant, you know what I mean? That's how I felt, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I probably had about 30 different polo suits that I got, you know, because we had many ways to make hustles back then. But every day I'll come out with a new suit on. You may see me wear a powder blue polo suit with a gold chain, you know, gold teeth. You know, just something real fly, you know what I mean? And that was kind of the persona of Prince Rakim. He was definitely a fly guy, as the word was back in those days.
Why don't we hear a 1991 record that you made as Prince Rakim, and this is Ooh, I Love You, Rakim.
Oh, no. Okay, let's go for it. Come on.
Okay.
It seems I'm a fiend for a sex routine. Love to hit them scream.
Ooh, Rakim.
And my response is, oh, always satisfy them. You know how I flow. With sex, I'm not lazy. I'm buck wild and crazy. I kiss the bosoms, but never eat the daisies. And my ladies love me deeply because I'm handsome, charming, and freaky. And when they meet me, they won't go. And now I'm stuck.
Okay, so let's move from Prince Rakim to the RZA. How does the RZA compare to Prince Rakim?
Well, when I came with Wu-Tang Clan, and the first single was called Protect Your Neck, and you'll notice in the video, it's like, exit Prince Rakim and enter the RZA. Because it was no time for me to be a pretty boy. It was no time for me to be this elegant guy that was, you know, into the ladies and into how I dressed and into how I looked. I became the RZA, basically, which was a total rebel, really. You know what I mean? You know, somebody that had it with society, and that was coming to get his fair take of society. You notice when I came in as the RZA, I was, you know, came very militant in my look. I was very militant in my action. I just went through so much different personal traumas, as far as with the law, with my life, with people in the streets, the hood, and I basically made a Z. You know what I mean? I made the first curve in my Z, shall I say, And I was like, you know, I'm not longer Prince, no longer Prince Rakim. That's part of my attribute, but I'm going to be the RZA. You know what I mean? Because, you know, that means I was strictly dealing with focusedness. It's funny because I didn't even like care how I dressed. I didn't even change my clothes that often. You know what I mean? I just was this one focused individual that was built on making a legacy for himself. And the Z in mathematics, you know what I mean? Because, you know, I study mathematics. And the Z stands for zigzag zig, which represents knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. It means, like, you can go this way, and sometimes you're going to have to zag back because you're going to go back and check on yourself. But then you realize you was going the right way in the beginning, so you zig again. And that shows you that sometimes you may know something, and you can understand it, but if you don't live through it, you know, it's not fully understood by you. And so that zag is me living it out. And when I zagged, you know, I went through so much troubles of life and life experiences. So now I have the experience. So now I had to zig again. And that's what really put that Z in my name. I was like, you know what? I don't went this way, that way. And now I understand which way I got to walk. And I actually walked a very straight, narrow line from the day that I took that title to RZA. I didn't really, commit sins or just, I was a real straightforward, focused, determined individual. And I gave myself a 5-year period, you know what I mean, of to make sure I stayed on that path. And that's what I did.
And after the 5 years?
Well, after the 5 years, which I basically had took that name in 1992. And then by 1997, my idea was I'll be on the top that musically, you know, and what I stood for would be the top of the top in the world. And I think in 1997 it happened. I think in 1997 Wu-Tang made it made a number one record or something like that. Was the number one hip-hop group, number one selling hip-hop group at the time, you know, nominated for Grammys and all that, you know, and really the number one influential groups at that time. So it actually kind of came to fruition from that five-year plan.
Well, I really want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan speaking with Terry Gross in 2005. Next up, our archive interview with Andre 3000. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Fresh Air.
Yo, chill with the feedback, black, we don't need that. It's 10 o'clock, ho, where the f*** you see that? Feeling mad hostile, ran out apostle, throwing like Christ when I speaks the gospel. Stole with the holy robe, then attack the globe with the buckets, style the ruckus. 10 times 10 men committing mad sin. Turn the other cheek and I'll break your f***ing chin. Slain boom bangs like African drums.
LB.
Coming around a mountain when I come. Crazy flamboyant for the rap enjoyment. My clan increased like black unemployment. Yeah, another one dare. Took a genius, take us the f*** out of here.
The Wu was too slamming for these coke killing labels. So ain't had hit since I seen Aunt Mabel. Be doing all the sin like Cain did Abel. Now they money's getting stuck to the...
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
We're commemorating the 50th anniversary of hip-hop this week. Next, we feature our interview with Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000, half of the duo Outkast, along with Antoine Patton, a.k.a. Big Boy. Their debut album, Southern Playalistic Cadillac Music, released 29 years ago, helped put Southern hip-hop on the map. Player's Ball from the album hit number one on the Billboard chart. Outkast's 2003 album Speakerbox, The Love Below, which included the hit Hey Ya, sold 11 million copies and won 3 Grammys. In all, they've released 7 albums, most of them platinum. Andre 3000 is known for his depth, and in the early 2000s, his exuberance and style. Esquire once named him the world's best-dressed man. He's collaborated with Beyoncé, Lil Wayne, Drake, and Frank Ocean. And he's also been an actor, appearing in films like Be Cool and Four Brothers, and on the TV shows The Shield and American Crime. In 2006, he co-created, wrote the music for, and voiced the main character of the Cartoon Network animated series Class of 3000. When Terry spoke with him, they had just made the movie Idlewild and wrote the soundtrack, which was a hybrid of hip-hop and jazz. Andre also starred in it. Here's a song from the soundtrack.
You said you wanted to, like, branch out from rapping because rapping's a young man's game, and one of the things you've been doing lately is acting. And you starred along with Big Boy Andre Patton from Outkast. You starred in the film Idlewild, which is set in a Georgia speakeasy you know, during Prohibition, and you're the piano player at the speakeasy. Mm-hmm. And even though it's the kind of speakeasy at which fights are constantly breaking out, the production numbers in it are as lavish as if it were the Cotton Club of Harlem.
Thank you.
And I thought we could hear, before we talk more about the movie, I thought we could hear the song that in the movie is the production number that plays at the very end of the film, behind the closed credit music.
And, PJ, I mean, and Rooster.
And you're at the piano in this at the start in a beautiful, like, tuxedo, and then you leave the piano to, like, sing and dance, and there are a scantily clad chorus line of dancers behind you, and there's stairways with dancers going up and down the stairs, like in the old production numbers.
Yeah.
So this is a fantastic song. Well, let's hear it, and then we'll talk.
Ain't nobody.
Andre Benjamin from the film Idlewild. Is this the kind of song that you would have written yourself if it wasn't for this movie?
Yes and no. Believe it or not, that song is about 6 years old.
Really?
And yeah, originally it was a guitar-based song, and it was kind of just me and the beat playing a guitar. And I had some of the lyrics even 5 years ago, and when we were doing this movie, I thought it worked perfectly. And so I had to change the production a little bit and make it more piano-based, because electric guitars, I mean, they were invented back then, but they weren't really where they are now. And I added a second and third verse, and Big Boy, you know, came on and put his thing on and make it what it is now. So, yes, I mean, even the lyric, you know, ain't nobody like my style. You know, I like my fire. They blow it out. You know, that was something that Andre 3000 was actually feeling, you know, 5 years ago before the movie came about. So it just so happened that when the movie came around, Percival was going through the same thing that Andre 3000 was going through. So it made total sense. And just the singing style was different, because the way I sang it before, it wouldn't work for 1930. So, you know, by listening to a lot of Cab Calloway things, you know, it was like big voice, big throat, like huge production, horns, you know. And so I just made it into what it is now.
I love the way you talk about Andre 3000 as if he were a person that you knew. You know.
Well, I know him sometimes. You know,
he's your persona for the band Outkast. So, how do you see Andre 3000 as compared to yourself, Andre Benjamin?
I guess if you can imagine, like, if you're a kid and you're in the mirror and you're playing dress up, and you're this other character, and as soon as your mom walks in, you change back into that person. And so Andre Benjamin was the kid that sat there and said, hey, what can I play? And he's in the mirror and he's putting on his cowboy and Indian suit. Once he puts on his outfits, once he starts to play and get into his kind of fun head, he's Andre 3000. You know, so Andre 3000 is that character within Outkast that kind of just goes there and has a ball, you know, does his thing. Andre Benjamin is, you know, the person that goes to Whole Foods, you know, that goes to the mall, you know, goes to the dry cleaners, you know, pumps gas, you know. That's my mama name. My mama gave me that name, Andre Lauren Benjamin.
And where does the 3000 come from?
Around 1999, right before it was, you know, about to turn into 2000, you know, the whole world was going crazy. Like, oh, man, my computers are going to change over, and they're going, we're all going to die, and, you know, everything's going to go kaput. And so 3000 actually means the year 3000, you know, the 3000 AD, kind of to look ahead and to keep myself excited. So the 3000 was tacked on to Andre because I have a kind of like a personality where I get bored really fast. So I have to find stuff to keep myself interested. And that's where the Cowboys and Indians come in.
Now, you know, the music that you were that you wrote for Idlewild, or that you changed for Idlewild, draws on music, a lot of different kinds of music, you know, like funk and hip-hop, but also early jazz. Did working on that movie expose you to music that you otherwise might not have listened to?
Of course. You know, growing up, I mean, I've always, you know, heard 30s or 40s music, but it was always, you know, in some other picture. It was always kind of like background music. Like, I can't say that I just ride around listening to 1930s, 40s music. I think the quality and the production, you know, is kind of different from what I'm used to right now. So when preparing for the role for Percival in Idlewild, I had to go meet morticians. You know, I had to go to funeral homes to actually see how these people live.
He plays a mortician, that's why. Yeah.
Yes. I play a mortician in Idlewild. So in preparing for the role, I had to go talk to morticians and had to sit down and ask them about their life. And I also had to get into the time frame of what was going on. So I watched a couple of movies from, you know, the 30s, 40s era, you know, things like Casablanca, a lot of Bugsy Berkeley movies, Stormy Weather, and, you know, things of that nature. And I listened to a lot of music, and mainly Cab Calloway. And it's funny because if you listen to Cab Calloway's music, he was actually rapping back in those times. But the sounds, you know, the big band sound, is I was introduced to it by the movie because I was never into it. So just to hear that kind of instrumentation, even though in Outkast music I've been producing songs that had, you know, horns before and, you know, those sounds, I mean, it's the arrangements, you know. So it's the horn blast and it's the way that the parts are written that are different. So so every song wasn't like this huge big band song. I mean, some of them had beats to them, you know, some of them had, I guess the stylings were kind of a funky version of 1930s.
Now, you're a character who is this kind of shy piano player at the speakeasy. Says about having to play there when he's forced into the spotlight during mm-hmm. one scene. He says, "I hate the spotlight." And I can't imagine you ever saying you hate the spotlight. You seem to just love performing so much and seem to have these kind of like old style show business values of loving to like sing and dance with costumes.
That's where the Cowboys and Indians come in.
Right.
Once again.
Yeah.
It's funny because when Brian Barber, who's the director and writer of Idlewild,
and who also directed your Hey video,
right, and Roses and a couple of others, but you know, I've known Brian since he was in film school in Atlanta at Clark, and you know, he'd come to parties and, you know, he'd say, "Hey man, I want you to be in my movie," and this is when we first came out, and he'd say, "Hey, I want you in this movie. Check out this script, or, you know, let's get together and just, you know, just come up with some ideas or whatever." So Brian has known me for a long time. He's known me. He's known Big Boy for a long time. So when we were putting this movie together, he knows our personalities that a lot of people don't know. You know, and it's funny you say that I seem like, okay, I love to jump on stage and I love to, you know, do the whole Hollywood. I love to sing and love to dance and love the spotlight and love to pose. And that's kind of not true. You know, it's kind of, I started doing music because I like to do it and I didn't know what I was getting into. So when he says, you know, I'm forced into a situation, I'm not really forced into it, but I kind of painted myself into a corner where I have to do it. But I do like to do music. But a lot of things that come along with it, you know, I'm not really a fan of. I just like to do great work. I like to create stuff. So be it music, film, whatever, you know, if the end product is good, you know, I'm loving it.
Andre 3000 of the hip-hop group Outkast speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the things that you have to learn as an actor is how to project vulnerability, because there are roles you're going to play in which you're vulnerable, and that's certainly the case in some scenes in Idlewild, for example. And vulnerability is in some ways exactly the kind of thing that a lot of rappers try to not express. Rappers on the whole, I mean, I think a lot of rappers try to maintain a very tough and hardened persona.
Right.
So I'm wondering, was there a transition for you of exposing more vulnerability both in your music and in your acting?
Yeah. I think, not just in rap, in life, period. When I started off, we were just, straight street rappers, and I do understand where it comes from. A lot of music guys or rappers have a hard time, getting rid of this character that they've built up, their whole career. And I don't think it's a thing of, them pretending or trying to be hard to put on. But it's like the street life, it won't allow you to show, that soft side because, you'll get trampled, just in the street. And so you have to kind of toughen up or man up in a certain kind of way. And if you built your whole career on letting people know, that I don't play, and you have to get into a character that does play or that does let other emotions come out, that may be a hard step, but even before I started doing film, in life, I knew I had to take my music other places because once again, I got bored with doing the same thing. So I got deeper and deeper into my music. And when I got deeper and deeper into my music, I had to expose certain sides of myself. And even when you look at Speaker Box and the Love Below was just that. That was the meaning of the Love Below. Like on the top of a man, you have this kind of hard shell or this kind of, I'm tough and nothing can hurt me. But the love below is those feelings that every man feels when he goes home, and he thinks about these things, and he thinks about his life. He thinks about his woman. He thinks about his kid. And there's no room to be tough there, so that's what the love below is about. So when it came time to act, it wasn't that much of a step because I knew that you have to be an actor. You can't act. That's the key. Once you act, people can see you acting, and that's not good. I talked to Mark Wahlberg, who kind of, I think he's done the transition the best, where people actually consider him more an actor than a music guy, and he said, and he's from the hardest parts of Boston, and he said, I had to make a point where I was like, am I going to put on for my homeboys in the neighborhood, or am I going to go out here and just do what I have to do?
Well, okay, so you were saying that, in your CD, The Love Below, that means the person beneath the tough veneer and the emotions beyond that tough exterior.
Right.
So let me play, the really big hit from this, which is Hey Ya, your song. And, this song is, so much fun. And I guess fun is one of the things that would not be good if you're trying to have that really tough exterior. Yes?
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because in the Hey Ya video, I had a lot of fun doing it, and you can see a lot of smiles, And I got a lot of feedback from just that alone, a lot of DJs and a lot of people on the street. They were like, man, that's cool, but I ain't seen a rapper smile in a long time, And I think smiling is powerful. You know? I mean, come on, God gave you teeth, he gave you lips, he gave you emotions. Come on, smile now. I mean, you ain't tough 24/7. You know, that's just not true. If you want to keep it real. Now, that's keeping it real.
Well, before we hear, hey, would you just talk a little bit about putting this together, like writing the song? You play all of the instruments except bass on it, I think.
Right.
So can you talk about, like, conceiving the record and, you know, conceiving the song and then the music happening behind the song?
With Hey Ya, that song was 3 years old before the public heard it. So a lot of times, like, I'll start a song, just a rough idea, and I'll move on to something else. And the song is just not ready for the people at the time. Sometimes it takes, you know, just that time to incubate or whatever. And so when I was working on The Love Below, I had a theme in my head, you know. It was about love. It was about emotion. So even when people are listening to Hey Ya and dancing around and, you know, they think it's crazy and they think it's fun, if you really pay attention to the lyrics, it's really a pretty dark song, you know. So it has that kind of, I guess, what do you call it, that dichotomy that kind of is dark on one end and it's light on the other end. But when putting it together, it was pretty much just me at home with my guitar, and I was playing these chords over and over and over again. I'm not a great guitar player, so these were some of the first chords that I ever learned. And, you know, during that time, you know, I was into a lot of garage, a lot of punk music, and I was just going for it. And so this was my interpretation of what I thought those sounds were. And the lyrics, usually they start from me messing around on my guitar playing, and I'll just start to kind of baby talk lyrics, you know, and I usually record myself on a micro cassette recorder. And so, you know, I'll be, yeah, 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 you know, and then I'll listen to it back and damn near translate what I'm saying, you know, like I almost have to decode my Yippity app, and that's what comes out, you know, my baby don't mess around because she loves me so, you know, and that's what came out, and it just starts to make sense after a while. And then I came back 3 years later working on the Speaker Box Love Below album and came back with the second verse. And then the, you know, Polaroid part, you know, that was kind of just a freestyle, actually, in the studio. And Beyonce's video was on the screen when I was doing the song. I forget which video it was, but I thought it was an amazing video and she was showing plenty of attitude. And so that's how she crept her way into the song, you know, when it says, now Beyonce's. And Lucy Liu's, those were actually commercials or scenes that were on the TV when I was in the vocal booth. And they crept their way into the song.
So you're describing how you speak in almost, you know, like baby talk when you're first writing
right.
The melody for the song. Is the hey ya part of the original baby talk?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Yes. And that's probably why it's hey ya, because I really didn't have any words, so you just, hey, yeah, you know.
Well, it works, doesn't it?
and then you fine-tune it, and you know it's saying, hey, yeah. It's kind of like really listening to another language, and then you listen back to it and say, oh, okay, now what is he saying? What is he saying? And then you make it out. You know, you've been a translator, and that's what happens. A lot of people get the song mistaken. They say, oh, man, I love that Hey Now song. Like, well, it's hey, yeah.
Well, here it is. And this is Andre Benjamin from the Outkast album Speaker Box, The Love Below.
1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
then what makes it, then what makes it, then what makes it cool?
Love the expansion.
So why yo, are we so in denial when we're not happy here?
That's Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000 of Outkast, on one of their big hits. We'll hear more of his interview with Terry Gross after a break. This is Fresh Air.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
We were talking before about how, as a rapper, a lot of people have a very kind of tough image, and that you kind of have to if you live in tough neighborhoods, otherwise people are going to take advantage of you. One of the things that you do is you design clothes, and you wear a lot of very kind of extravagant theatrical clothes, you know, on stage and in videos, in movies. And I'm wondering how that fits in with, like, the tough exterior that you needed to have when you were growing up. Did you wear theatrical clothes when you were young, or is that an indulgence you couldn't afford because it would have been too weird?
Well, no, actually, in high school, I mean, it was still a lot about style. Like in Atlanta, it was called, you know, being a prep. And when you're a prep, it's kind of like it was like a clothes culture. And we were considered what you would call, like, low heads. And this was, even though, you know, Ralph Lauren, I think he started in 67, he was kind of like the general of this whole stylesman, you know, thing. And as a kid, you know, that's all we wanted to be. We wanted to look like, you know, we wanted to look like we had it, look like we went to college. And so everybody, we were into clothes, and we did certain things with them. Like, in our own funky kind of way, like, we would take pants and we would dye them different colors. Or we'd wear, you know, two or three different color polo shirts on top of each other just so we can have color combinations and all this type of stuff. So it was a real style thing. So that's always been in me. But I think people get the stage antics and the stage wear, I think, mixed up with streetwear. You know, when you're on stage, you know, you wear the white wigs, or you wear, you know, these Indian, you know, no shirt and, you know, huge furry pants or whatever. I mean, but those are not things that happen on the street, though, you know. So to answer your question, they don't fit in. You know, that doesn't fit in with it. But at the same time, the attitude that you do it with, you know, some of the hardest people on the street, you know, they come up to me and be like, man, you know, I love what you do. And I think it comes from the attitude of what you're wearing, not actually what you're wearing.
Well, Andre Benjamin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Andre 3000 of Outkast spoke to Terry Gross in 2006. On Monday's show, we'll conclude our series of hip-hop interviews with Jay-Z, regarded as one of the most successful rappers of all time. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Charlie Kyer. We'll close out with music by Cab Calloway, who Andre 3000 said he was listening to in preparation for the movie soundtrack Idlewild. For Terry Gross, I'm Tanya Mosley.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate, too. Here's Cacciatore, Dory. taste of bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.